Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com. accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast coming to you from Montecito, California. And we are just a couple weeks away from a presidential election. Boy, oh boy, we live in interesting times, don't we? We've got a global pandemic, a recession, a divided country. This country is more divided than I have ever seen it in my life. All of that heading into an election year. And, you know, from the perspective of what we talk about on this show, which is not politics, it's the economy. Anyone who says they know for sure which way the economy is headed in the next 6 months, well, they're kind of lying to you. I'm not saying that, you know, that they may not be right. It's just, it's still kind of a weird place, right? I mean, how long is it going to take? Did any of us really think we were going to be wearing masks and this long when this first thing started? And, you know, now we're hopefully getting close to a vaccination, but gosh, how long is it going to take for that to really create a herd immunity? How many people are going to take it? How many people are not? So what can we do about all this uncertainty, you know, about the future? From an economic standpoint, well, that's what being a sophisticated investor is all about, right? I mean, you kind of have to know a little bit of macroeconomics. You have to understand what's happening around you in the world, what's affecting prices in not only various asset classes, but sub-asset classes. So for example, whereas, you know, a lot of commercial real estate around the country has just gotten absolutely hammered, we've actually been very fortunate that our accredited investor club, which you can sign up for, by the way, at wealthformula.com, we are very heavy on working class apartment buildings and self-storage, specifically in rapidly growing landlord-friendly states. In fact, in those cities, we are seeing a further compression of cap rates because of increased demand, and that increased demand is coming from big money, people who have not bought in, for example, in Arizona before because they were buying it only in New York and California. Well, now they want to buy in Texas. They want to buy in Arizona. So there's all sorts of new money coming in. And then on top of that, low interest rates. One comment about the interest rates, too. I've heard a lot of people say, well, who would have ever guessed that interest rates would have been lower, right, a year ago? And it's funny because I can think of one guy who did. It wasn't me, by the way. But if you remember, if you came to one of our Wealth Formula events, one of the principals of Western Wealth Capital, David Steele, did an entire talk, and the thesis essentially was our interest rates are, you know, higher than anywhere else in the world, and they're only going to get lower. So he's the only guy, I think, who really predicted it, and I got to give my hands off to Dave there. He really he got that right. That's Western Wealth Capital, which is one of our investor club partners. Anyway, you know, that said, you know, regardless of some potential short-term volatility in these areas that we're in, I mean, we don't know. I mean, there could still be some increases and vacancy, and rent collection issues and stuff like that in the short term. I mean, we are extremely well capitalized. So the good news is I am extremely bullish as ever on our investor club thesis of focusing on what I would call essential real estate. But to be clear, I will tell you again, I mean, I'm not going to be disingenuous and suggest that real estate in general is not correlated with other markets as a whole. It is, and it is affected by what else happens in other markets. But the thing is that usually when you identify something that isn't correlated, you know, something that's really considered uncorrelated to the economy, the problem there is you usually don't make a whole lot of money, right? It's usually a very uninteresting pro forma in addition to being uncorrelated. So, however, I will say that there has been one, you know, big in my investments, personal investments, there has been one major exception to this rule, which really has performed extremely well throughout, you know, good times and bad, and really through COVID. In the last 3 or 4 years, I've been investing in various ventures in the automatic teller machine space. Yes, you heard me, automatic teller machines, ATMs. Okay, so you're thinking, who uses cash these days anyway, right? Who's walking around with a wad of cash? Or more broadly, why in the world would I invest in ATM machines, Buck? Well, these are good questions, and I can't say that I didn't say the same thing or think the same thing when I first heard about these kinds of investments. And well, it's the devil's in the details. You know for a fact by this point, at least in theory, that I am not reckless when it comes to investing. I am advocating for boring. I like boring, right? More boring, the better. And especially when that comes to your money in Investor Club, you know, with our accredited investor group, we are going to be very careful with that stuff. Even if I go decide to do something crazy on my own, I'd rather not bring you along with me at this point. So believe me, investing in ATM machines actually does make a lot of sense right now. And I want you to listen to this podcast to explain why. Because if done properly, ATM investments can be highly profitable, which is what we like. But you can also write off your investment against any passive income you earn with current bonus depreciation provisions in the tax code. In other words, if you have a surgery center making a couple $100,000 a year and you invest a couple $100,000 into an ATM fund the way we have it, guess what? We just wiped away your tax liability from that passive income from your surgery center. And then, of course, again, ATM machines are uncorrelated to the economy. Put that together with an institutional level operator, institutional level portfolio, and frankly, there is not that much there not to like, in my humble opinion. So anyway, to tell us more about this opportunity and what this is all about, I've invited our new investor club partner, Daryl Heller. Now, Daryl has been around for a long time. He's a venture capitalist. He's an entrepreneur, and he's the founder of Heller Capital. And he's one of our new partners at the Accredited Investor Club. But when we come back, Daryl is going to tell us all about this entire concept of investing in ATM machines.
Worried about saving too little too late for retirement? The Wealth Accelerator may be exactly what you need. With the help of some of the oldest and most reliable insurance companies in the country, Wealth Accelerator allows you to take most of the upside of any good year in the stock market and use bank loans to magnify those returns significantly. And what if the stock market has a bad year? No need to fear. Wealth Accelerator is engineered so you don't participate in the losses of the market, no matter how bad of a year it is. Sounds too good to be true, right? But it's not. It's simply the same financial engineering that the ultra wealthy have been doing for years. Now it's your turn. Check it out for yourself by going to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com. Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession-resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, my guest on Wealth Formula Podcast is Daryl Heller. Daryl is a venture capitalist and an entrepreneur and the founder of Heller Capital, which he is also the CEO of. And Heller Capital and Daryl are actually the newest partners of the Wealth Formula Investor Group with some exciting stuff going on over there. So with that, Daryl, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Buck. Pleasure to be part of the show today. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. And, you know, so just for those who don't have an idea of exactly kind of where, what exactly you're doing there over at Heller Capital, maybe you can kind of tell us about what that is. And then ultimately, specifically, you know, why you got into the business that we're going to talk about today, which is the business of automatic teller machines or ATM machines.
No, I'd be glad to. So my history is telecom technology entrepreneur. Started my first company when I was in college, ended up being fortunate enough to take a few to financial events. And then in about the 2012 time period, I moved into private equity. And Heller Capital Group owns anywhere from 12 to 15 operating companies, 3 to 5 private placements at any given time, and, you know, has a market cap of around $500 million right now. In terms of ATMs, that's a bit more interesting. In 2011, I ended up having an opportunity to invest into this space, and I did a significant amount of diligence and found out there's very thick operating margins. And initially saw it, and still do today, as a real estate play where we could capture a lot of real estate and end up monetizing that real estate with things beyond ATM. So, but we're sitting here, you know, many years later, 9, going on 10 years later, and having the same success and even higher success, as we'll talk about today, I'm sure, than we had back in 2011. So, you know, that's how I got into the space. I have about $15 million in the ATM space. I'm a firm believer in the old Microsoft adage that you eat your own dog food first. And accordingly, you know, I've done just that.
Yeah. And we're talking about $15 million, your own money in there. So how do you make money from owning ATMs? I mean, you know, give us a sense of, you know, what, you know, how does, of course, when you go to a Chase and you already have a Chase account, you don't pay any money. But a lot of this has to do with, you know, the surcharges, right? How does that work? And, you know, what kind of volumes do you typically see in an ATM machine in a given day?
Yeah, so we are, our ATMs are in what I would call a very defined demographic that is strategic by nature. For example, mall groups, we deselected about 5-6 years ago. Fortunately, we did with COVID as they got crushed there. We saw online retail really impacting it. So our demographic is in this kind of unbanked and underbanked. That's a high percentage of it. I'm sure we'll speak more to that later. But in terms of how we make money within that demographic, essentially an operator, our management company, charges a user, you know, anywhere from $250 to $350 for each transaction that they make. Plus on top of that, the operator makes around 25 cents for something called interchange. So their revenue stream would be surcharge plus interchange. And then the rule of thumb, this varies obviously, Buck, but the rule of thumb is 20 to 30% could go to the retail location. 25 to 30% goes into the WF Velocity fund that we're talking about today. And then generally in that, you know, 40 to 55% is retained by the management company to operate the ATM. And then the management company aggregates ATMs into large pools, blends the returns for WF Velocity Fund. It removes seasonality, the demographic issues, all those other volatilities. And then we, as the owner of the ATM, get paid a percentage of that surcharge generated at the ATM.
So it's pretty straightforward. So
that's how it works. In terms of, you ask volume levels, if you're going to use a rule of thumb for the type of demographics we're in, we're generally around that in that 500 range. We get paid on slightly less than that. The management company keeps insurance buffer in there for themselves, which is, you know, how we came through COVID completely unimpacted.
Right.
But that's essentially, you know, the revenue model and how you make money with an ATM.
So one of my, one of the members of an investor club emailed me when we started, we had this offering, the WF Velocity Fund, which is open, of course, only to accredited investors. And he says, the first question I had in my mind is, who uses cash? No, I know I don't use it much, and you probably don't either. However, statistically, year over year, the cash numbers are actually going up. Isn't that correct? So who's using cash?
Yeah, that is correct. The monetary system's growing both in the U.S. There's some interesting stats in the U.S. and certainly at a worldwide level. But yeah, I asked myself the same question back in 2011. And I remember reading an article from 1999 in the Wall Street talking about cash will be dead in a few years. Well, you know, we're now 20 plus years beyond 1999 and cash is actually growing. And we now have empirical data for the last 9 years to actually show that it's incrementing up, not decrementing down. And it really comes down to, again, that demographic issue. Buck, you and I and many of the people on this listening to the show today are not using their ATM card much. However, the focus is those that lack credit, thus credit card access. So again, that unbanked and underbanked, which is a large demographic already and a growing demographic. So it's those who lack credit and thus credit card access, you know, credit challenges, those who use prepaid cards, which kind of plays into the EBT side. Our government welfare system is now running a prepaid and has been for many years and will continue to be. So that's a big focus of our demographic is people using their EBT card. And it's essentially their bank. An ATM is seen as their bank, given a lot of them don't have bank accounts. They're working on prepaid cards. And then, you know, ATMs get used for transferring funds and other functions in lieu of online banking, which kind of ties into, you know, there's a demographic of people out there that just distrust credit cards, given all the credit card breaches at some of the big retailers over the past few years, and just prefer to do their online on a machine versus, you know, through, you know, their version of how it would run on the internet side. So, and then, you know, there's just a segment of people when it's growing that simply prefer cash. That maybe don't fit into the unbanked and underbanked, but they prefer cash. I mean, for example, 10 years ago, you know, all employers would give you a paycheck and you'd go to the bank and cash your paycheck and take a couple $100 out. Now it's all ACH or wired. So, you know, at some point you have to go get cash and all banks are seeing, you know, traffic counts going way down. They're closing branches and they're starting to see ATMs as a vault on the street. And many of the ATMs that are in this portfolio will be branded by the big banks as well. So you know, Buck, you already own some ATMs. Some of those ATMs have some bank brands on it. So if you walk up to it or a user does, they may think it is XYZ Bank, when in reality, it's your ATM and they're just paying to brand on it. And that's the banks are seeing that's put vaults out there. So access to cash is easier. And that's changing the demographic game a bit more where there's a broader demographic people using it. I do use an ATM more than I used to. I'm not sure if that's because I'm an investor in it and have an affinity towards it now, or if it's just a real change in my behavior. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, you make a very interesting point. I think a lot of people don't think about this, but, you know, there is this overall shift, you know, in the workforce of increased you know, sort of automation and, you know, replacing individuals with technology. And ATM machines have a function beyond, you know, getting your cash out, right? So, I mean, surcharges for that are part of that is just, you know, banking, period, right? So you're just, you have banking transactions going on there. The other thing that I think for me, at least, you know, and I've just my own noticing what people talk about in this space versus what's reality is that, you know, the idea that about cash and its use going away, I mean, first of all, as you know, it's going up as we talked about. Second of all, there's no legislation. There's no legislation on this matter in the U.S. And this is a generational change. It's not like, oh, gosh, every you know, the next day we're going to wake up and there's going to be no cash. The reality is that people like cash. I think there's some statistic about, you know, well over 70-80% of people oppose the idea of going to a cashless society. And the other interesting thing is that in areas like the Bay Area, where various merchants have tried to, you know, stop taking cash, they've actually come under fire as being quote unquote racist because they're not open to people who primarily function in cash. Some comments on that, Daryl?
Yeah, no, really interesting subject matter there. I mean, I put it kind of under cash relevance because it's a question I get asked a lot and a question that I and we still do a lot of diligence on. So, you know, we talked about this, you know, demographic issue that uses EBT, et cetera, but then you get into just, and that's not changing, that's actually growing. So our demographic is growing, not decreasing. But then you get into things like you spoke about. There is no pending regulation out there. There is no regulatory risk on the horizon relative to cash. In fact, there's a bill out there called Payment Choice Act of 2019. I think it's Bill 2850. It has bipartisan support. I think it has 38 co-sponsors from both sides of the aisle. And that kind of plays into what you saw occurring. You referenced other countries, some large retailers. You got countries like India, Sweden, Spain, China. There's quite a few others that made a run at becoming cashless and all reversed it in pretty quick order. Then you got some large retailers. I mean, Walmart started some pretty big pilots, discontinued the pilot quickly. McDonald's, United Airlines. I mean, you can go on and on. And, you know, those have all been reversed. And it is a discrimination issue. There's some local governments, state governments that have already put regulation out there in the discriminatory side. But again, there's some federal things being worked on. And then if you just go and look at the U.S., I mean, this is an interesting fact that I read recently. And in the U.S., as of 9:30, so, you know, less than a month ago, there was $2 trillion in circulation of cash in the U.S., and that's a 22% increase from January of this year. So you can sit here and say, did COVID impact it negatively? You know, how does this pandemic that we're still in today impact cash? Well, it's certainly not hurting it. And
well, one of the things,
anything, it's increasing it. And this perception of the virus contained in bills and stuff, most of those myths have been dispelled by now.
One of the things you mentioned, which I thought was fascinating, and I didn't realize this, is a lot of the government programs are prepaid, you know, ATM cards. Right. I mean, they're basically debit cards and people can go in, and the way they're getting their cash is through those cards. So that probably explains why you've got so much cash coming in. Anyway, so I've invested in ATMs myself over the past 3-4 years through, you know, your various funds. And what's striking to me, and I did it admittedly, you know, for me, a lot of it was a tax play, and there was, you know, attractive returns along with the tax play and all that stuff. But over the last 3-4 years, I've noticed a couple of things. First, the monthly payments were never missed. And even during COVID-19, again, to me, I was like, oh, COVID-19's happening. How is that, you know, who's going to get cash? But to your point, I mean, if a large segment of the population relies on cash to just buy the basics, you know, everyone's being forced to stay at home, but they still have to eat, right? I mean, isn't that basically, is that what happened? I mean, why was this, what made it so strong, you know, other than the, you know, the prepaid debit cards? Is that pretty much the main driver, you think, or?
Yeah, so I think it's a couple fold, but, you know, again, if you go to the prepaid debit cards, that becomes a demographic issue. And, you know, that unbanked, underbanked. In fact, many of those came out of this pandemic with a whole lot of money, more than they were typically getting, as you well know. So that played into it. There's also this perception when you go into a pandemic, some people want to hoard cash. We saw massive runs in some large cities, which is unbelievable amount of cash usage out. Some of our ATMs were up 2 to 3x from what they were year over during that time period. So, but when you really look at COVID and you say, how did we weather that storm, Buck? It was really the demographic issue. It was these central locations. Did we have a few ATMs shut down? Of course we did. But we had many ATMs that were performing at the level they had previous to COVID, and many that were performing at levels well beyond what they had performed. So, you know, for example, when you take most impactful four-week period of time, we were down around 12%. Now, you read some industry reports, which include bank ATMs, retail ATMs, and mall ATMs that were down 30%, a lot of operators. But again, because of this very narrow band, very acute focus relative to demographic, you know, that was worst case, down about 10% in our, or 12%, excuse me, in our segments. And then that just started to come back. I will say in July, year over year, same store, same ATM, we were up, literally up from 2019. August the same. I've yet to see September numbers, but I'll be shocked if that's not the case. So, it really comes down to where our ATMs were placed. We did not have many in non-essential locations, and they're in C stores, and they're in places where that demographic was actually having more cash than they had prior to COVID because of all the government, you know, supplemental or subsidy programs that are out there. So, and then I think there was a higher percent of people that were using ATMs that wanted to pull cash out. That, and they may, a bank was closed, they couldn't go into a bank. Yeah. So they had to go to their bank on the street or bank in a convenience store. So there's a lot of really interesting elements when you start to kind of pull the layers back on that and look under it. But that would be a few of them. And, you know, it's the reasons September, August, and I think, July, August, and I think September will be year over same store. Up from 2019.
So with all that being said, is it fair to say, and do we have statistics to say that investments in ATMs, you know, at least in terms of the way we're looking at it through this fund model, is uncorrelated to the economy at large?
Yes, I would agree with that assessment. I'd suggest cash stays, you know, relative consistent, regardless of bull or bear market, for all the, you know, aforementioned reasons we spoke about. Again, you study the demographic, you're just not going to see the volatility in those EBT users. In fact, you're going to see an increase to it, irrespective of bull or bear market.
So our investor club and your group have partnered now and offer what we are calling the WF, and that's, of course, it's Wealth Formula, WF Velocity Fund. Can you talk about how the fund works in general? It is, I should point out that it is a Reg D 506C offering, which means it's open to accredited investors only, and that's why we can actually talk about it on this podcast specifically. But maybe you could, you know, maybe you could kind of give people an idea of how that fund works and, you know, maybe get into the numbers a little bit, et cetera.
Absolutely. So there's an allocation of ATMs that have been allocated to this fund as an opportunity. It's not an obligation, but it's an allocation that we've worked with WF Velocity Fund on. So essentially investor club members would make an investment. The unit is 104,000. You can also purchase a half unit, which is 52,000. And from that, the ATMs are purchased. They're then placed by the operator, or what we would call the management company, in these target demographics that we've defined here today. And then the ATM is operated by that management company, that operator. So they're certified ISO. They fall under a lot of regulatory accountability. They have a sponsor bank. They have annual audits. They have random audits, just to give you some security and transparency on that side. All ATMs are EMV, ADA, PCI compliant. And then they're contracting. Some of it is insourced, some of it's outsourced. They're contracting with individuals to essentially operate that ATM. So you have processors, the same processors your bank uses, like Fiserv and Elan, are the ones processing these transactions. They have bailment contracts. They have two large national Wall Street banks that's providing the cash to put into the vaults of the ATMs. They hire Armored, which is secure transport, your Loomis, Brinks, Garda trucks that you see driving around as we're on the highway these days. And then they have maintenance companies. Some of it is insourced. They have some of their own maintenance teams, but they have maintenance companies that will roll a truck to an ATM. A lot of it is the reboots, and a lot of the maintenance and diagnostics are done remotely these days, but there's still, you know, requirements to roll trucks at times. And then they insure the cash in the ATM. So if someone steals that ATM or goes in and puts a sledgehammer to it, whatever it may be, you know, we take on none of that risk. And as noted earlier, we then get paid a percentage of that surcharge in these blended pools to remove our volatility, and, you know, makes for a very nice investment on our side.
Yeah. So basically the idea here, is that you buy a unit, which is, you know, or a half unit, So that's either six or three ATM machines, and you own those, right? And then, but really, what you're doing is you're taking, you're signing a venture agreement, and then in order to sort of really mitigate that risk of volatility, the income produced by those machines goes into a larger pool, you know, thousands of machines, to really flatten out and stabilize the return, which is then returned as a fixed return over the course of 7 years in monthly dividends. Do you want to talk a little bit about what those returns look like in this? And this is subject to change, but we're talking as of October and almost November here of 2020.
Yes, glad to. And just a bit on the pooled or blended funds or pools of ATMs. In the early days, it was variable. And the challenge we had is we had investor A and investor B sitting in the same country club when one individual was, Sally was getting a lot more than John, just by virtue of where it was placed. So to kind of level all that out, to take the seasonality out, to take the demographic issue out, they pull thousands of ATMs, which not only manages risk for all of us, but it flattens that, you know, that ATM yield out and doesn't create those volatilities up and down on a monthly basis. But yeah, to the returns, I'll use that as the segue. You know, I'll put three metrics out there. You have your, you know, your cash on cash, and the cash on cash returns here are very high. But again, you're making an investment in a piece of equipment, an asset that depreciates it down. So, you know, don't let this be misleading to you. I say that from a conservative lens, but the real cash on cash is, you know, 25.2%. And then the cash on cash, when you factor in depreciation, which I'm sure we'll talk about today, actually goes up to 33.2 if you factor it in at 40%. So strong cash on cash, but at the end of that 7 year contract, your ATM for something, but very little, because it's a fatigue depreciated asset. Rate of return, which, you know, I like to look at, that's 11.3%. Rate of return with depreciation is 17.0%. And then, you know, IRR, which is what many people look at in this space, without depreciation would be 16.5%. And with depreciation, you know, it's up slightly over 30%.
Yeah. So the internal rate of return, this is something we don't talk a lot about, frankly, in the real estate world, because we tend to use different language. We often talk about annualized returns, but one of the values here in using this internal rate of return number is that it takes into consideration the time value of money. And so for a fixed, for something that's a depreciating asset over 7 years, that's a very, very important number. And a lot of it just is about how quickly you're getting your money back with consideration of what else you could do with the money. In other words, I mean, that's sort of like the high level explanation of internal rate of return. The now Daryl was talking specifically about with or without depreciation. You know, we talk a lot on this show about tax implications of investing and tax efficient investing. And so basically this is a piece of equipment and it can be it's depreciated. So it's not just because of a current law, but any equipment. If I buy medical equipment, it can be through my business, it can be depreciated over 5 years down to zero. And similarly, with just like depreciation in other areas that we talk about right now, there is the idea of bonus depreciation with the Trump law or Trump tax changes, at least temporarily, at least for the time being, you can take all of that depreciation up front. So if you had a $104,000 investment and you have passive income to offset, that's important. It's a passive income. Then you can offset that income with the you know, passive deduction you're getting from these machines. So that is actually a huge, huge opportunity. And honestly, it's one of the main reasons that I've done this. I mean, obviously the returns are very attractive, but you throw in the additional element of an internal rate of return exceeding 30. You put that together with you know, being able to write the whole thing off during bonus depreciation time. really it's like getting your money back in less than 3 years. And to me, that's a really interesting proposition. So, Daryl, do you have anything to add on the tax side? Because I know we it's funny because when we did this presentation, when we did it originally as a webinar, I think you were probably taken aback by the sheer volume of tax questions. But my group is completely obsessed with the concept of tax efficient investing.
Yeah, clearly you have a very sophisticated group of investors. Personally, Buck, I think this is one of the more significant opportunities that our current tax, code law has. And I don't think it'll be here long term. I mean, depending on administration changes in the next, couple, 2 weeks? Well, we'll start in January, but decisions made in the next couple of weeks. I do think this is an opportunity when you get into 2021 that at a minimum will be reduced, if not completely removed. But yeah, it's powerful because if you think about it, you can depreciate 100% of your investment in that first year. So, take round numbers, take 5 units, take 520K. And let's just say you're taking bonus depreciation and you're in that 40% tax bracket all in. So essentially that's 208,000 right. Off of that, that essentially is depreciated or coming off. So your net basis, if you will, is 312K, but you're going to get the return of a 520K investment. Now that does presume that you have some other passive income, as was noted by you. You're naturally going to have passive income generated that first year, so you have that against it, so you won't need the full 208. But you're going to have some other passive investment to kind of run that financial model hypothetical that I just put out there. But it's powerful, even if it's at a carry forward, even if you're just shielding, all your income that first year, because you can get in and say your entire income, your first year, 2 years, is shielded through bonus depreciation. So it is a very impactful tool and one that, I've utilized for years and am hopeful that it does not go away. But yeah. I think we may be looking at a 3, 4, 5, 6 month run on this.
I agree with that on the bonus depreciation side. And, Tom Wheelwright, my CPA, was on the show a couple weeks ago, and we talked about this issue of bonus depreciation. It's one of the things that he, whereas a number of the things in the real estate space, he does not believe are really going to go away. He doesn't think 1031s are going to go away, et cetera. Bonus is going to go away. And the question of when it goes away is really when the legislation comes up for it to go away. Because once it gets ratified, which it almost certainly will, then it reverts back to the date that legislation was put forward. So it seriously could be, sometime relatively early next year. That's certainly a possibility. So what I like about the bonus depreciation I'll just take one thing that I'll really like about it, because you don't have to do this over bonus depreciation, but you can. And to me, it's attractive because say you don't use that depreciation because you don't have enough passive income. Well, you just carry it forward and try to figure out a way to create more passive income. We talked about that on the Tom Show. Those of you who've got surgery centers, they've got infusion centers, you've got dialysis centers, this is all passive income. And if your CPAs are not calling it passive income, then you should seriously consult another CPA, because you have an opportunity here potentially to wipe out like all the taxes that you would pay on that. Again, I'm not a CPA, but this is stuff that we've talked about a fair amount, and I feel fairly confident in telling you that this stuff works. Daryl, one more question for you, and because people initially, I think sometimes they also hear like, oh, this is an ATM play, and it sounds a little, even for the alternative people, it sounds a little alternative, right? But this is not a mom and pop show. Talk a little bit about the partners here, because this is a, this is a top five operator. This is, we've got some people on the board here who are, this is high level stuff. This is not like a rookie crew. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I'd be glad to. So yeah, our operator, our management company, is top five in the US. They've got close to 10,000 ATMs. They've got up times of 98.5%. So they are a best in class operator out there. And this space, you know, you can kind of break it down into, to use your phraseology, that the mom and pop, and then the more larger institutional players. So we're working with a bona fide, growing, very successful, profitable, operator management company, which gives us a lot of security. And beyond that, what really helps, and I noted this earlier, at risk of being redundant, I'll bring it up again, and that is they have a sponsor bank. To do it at this level, they do fall under a lot of regulatory scrutiny. So, they do have audits and process systems, financial viability audits, et cetera. So, to be an operator, to operate at this level, you have to be an organization that is best in class, that does well, and that operates, a fundamentally sound business.
So you've got an institutional quality group of individuals and operators with an institutional level, a significant portfolio, attractive monthly payments, hedge against the economy, and it's highly tax efficient. it sounds like a pretty good opportunity, and I assume you would think so too, ladies and gentlemen. You can learn more about this at WFVelocity.com. Daryl and I did a presentation together, and you can check that out there. Again, that's WFVelocity.com. Daryl, I want to thank you very much for giving us your time today and explaining what I think is a particularly interesting investment given the time that we're in, from an economic standpoint, from a volatility standpoint, from the tax advantages that we have currently. So thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. I enjoyed our time. Thank you as well.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. I think it is a very interesting and exciting investment to consider. And if you'd like to learn more, go to WFVelocity.com. Again, that's WF as in Wealth Formula, Velocity.com. You can watch the presentation that Daryl and I did. This is open only to accredited investors. It is a Reg D 506C offering. But check it out if you'd like to learn more. One thing I should point out is the returns themselves are, obviously it's definitely nice yield, right? It's the internal rate of return is pretty impressive, et cetera. But one thing I got to tell you is once you couple this with something like a Wealth Formula banking, the numbers really start to go insane. So I'm going to have Rod and Christian put together a pro forma for that as well and send that out as well to you. But in the meantime, if you already have a Wealth Formula banking policy, definitely talk to Rod and Christian about how you might be able to use it in conjunction with this kind of investment. Anyway, that's it for me this week on Wealth Formula Podcast. This is Buck Joffrey signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Joffrey here from Save You with Buck Joffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at SaveYouPodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, SaveYouPodcast.com.